Good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming out on a snowy and icy day. It's great to see everybody. About a year ago, in 2014, a controversial article was published in the New Yorker magazine. Maybe some New Yorker readers here. It was written by the comedian and actress Lena Dunham. Stars in an HBO series, has sort of the whole, a career in Hollywood. And the article was titled, Dog or My Jewish Boyfriend? And the content of this article, which was in the satire section, shouts and murmurs of the New Yorker magazine, was ostensibly a quiz with 20 or 30 questions. And the idea was the reader is supposed to decide whether the question or the statement applies to Lena Dunham's dog or to her Jewish boyfriend. So it consisted of things like, he's covered in dark hair all over his body, or when we go out for dinner, he doesn't tip. Now, that line didn't get a laugh, and I think there's a reason, because it wasn't particularly funny. And most of the criticism in this article had to do with humor. It just didn't work. Some of the criticism, though, especially within the Jewish community, had to do with this pairing of Jews and dogs. So the Anti-Defamation League released a statement, B'nai B'rith, and other organizations released press releases indicating that they find this kind of humor not only not humorous, but objectionable, in that it draws on longstanding anti-Jewish tropes, the idea of Jews being cheap, right, or in control of money, but especially that pairing between Jews and animals. And I gave you a few images on the front cover of this sheet, just to give you a sense of the long and sort of unfortunate history of this pairing. So we'll start on the top right, a sign from the United States from the early 20th century, no Jews, no dogs, no African Americans allowed within specific vicinities, and obviously the pairing of undesirable minorities with an animal is meant to be disparaging. A play actually right underneath that was released off-Broadway in the early 21st century takes the same title, having to do with racial and interreligious relations in America. On the top left, this appeared in a cafe in Turkey not long ago. Sorry, we did not receive dogs or Israelis, sort of an updating of that pairing for the modern era. Similar idea on a sign that appeared in a cafe in Belgium on the bottom left, where it said that entrance to dogs is fine, but entrance to Zionists is completely off-limits. And then last but not least, people, anybody seen Life is Beautiful? The 1997 movie, fantastic movie from many different perspectives, but for our purposes, it has a particularly resonant scene where Joshua, the young child, who will end up going with his father to the camps, sees a sign on the window, on the bottom part of the sheet here, entrance is forbidden to both Jews and dogs. And I gave you, I'm not going to read through this whole thing, but I gave you the dialogue here where he says, no Jews or dogs allowed, why aren't they allowed to go in? And his father has to try to explain to him, without exposing him to the nature of anti-Semitism, why it is that somebody would put up a sign that says no Jews or dogs. So he goes through all other kinds of pairings that other stores don't allow in. This store doesn't let in Chinese or kangaroos. This store doesn't let in Spanish people or horses. And it's a funny scene, but obviously very poignant given the content. Now, the pairing between Jews and dogs might initially seem strange from a number of different perspectives. Why Jews in particular with dogs in particular? Any dog lovers here? Probably people here. I'm guessing a few people at least have pets, right? And the idea that you would have a dog and love a dog and that a dog would be a member of your family is a very common modern notion. But it's very much a modern notion. And so I wanted to give a few examples of the history before we get into our main subject for today, the history of this pairing between Jews and dogs in a disparaging way. So on the bottom of the second sheet, page number 2, this is an image from a woodcut from Germany in the early modern period describing Judenstrafe, which was Jewish execution. How were Jews executed, especially in Germany from the 13th century onward? Okay, this begins in the 13th century and picks up steam going forward. So you would execute a Jew by hanging him upside down. Okay, you don't hang him from his neck, you hang him upside down, which is a much slower and much more horrible way to perish, between two wild dogs. You can see the image here on the bottom. There's a dog on either side, so the dogs are going to die too, but before they get to that point, they're going to be mauling the Jewish criminal sort of all the way to the end. A really horrific kind of an idea. If you take a look on the top of the third page, you'll see that the pairing of Jews and dogs has all kinds of other ramifications and manifestations as well. So, for example, many of you may know that during the First Crusade in 1096, Jews were slaughtered by bands of crusaders who were traveling east through the Rhineland, through Germany. Many Jews, however, converted rather than give up their lives. We tend to privilege and to know about the Jews who died al Kiddush Hashem. But we know from lots of sources, including Jewish sources, that there were many Jews who converted temporarily and then reverted eventually to Judaism, and there were all kinds of halachic issues that came up. Well, Christians were aware of this too. And so when they discussed Jews who had converted to Christianity temporarily and then eventually reverted to Judaism, they universally applied Mishlei Chaf Vav Yud Aleph Kekelev Shav El Keo Ksil Shenebe Ivlatoa. As just as a Jew, as a dog returns to its vomit, so too fools can't stop returning to their foolish actions, and that was applied to Jews in particular. The Christian scriptures have verses that talk about dogs as well that are applied to Jews. So, for example, it's not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. From the 13th century onward, this was applied to Jews as the dogs, and the children's food, or the bread that the Gospels warns not to cast to the dogs, was the host. This is the time when we see host desecration libels, a very common trope in the later Middle Ages, where Jews are accused of breaking into churches, stealing consecrated wafers that Christians use in their worship, and stabbing them, and desecrating them, or flushing them down the toilet, doing all sorts of horrible things to them. And again, the Jews are the dog in this equation, and this is a very widespread linkage that was very much an element of popular culture. And not just dogs. It's worth emphasizing that Jewish animality, Jewish bestiality, the notion that Jews are essentially non-human animals, again, from the Middle Ages in particular, picked up a tremendous amount of steam and had all kinds of very damaging and very dangerous ramifications. I give just a couple of examples here, again, images and texts. On the left-hand side, you may see a picture of the owl here. You can make it out inside that circle. Owls in the Middle Ages were Jews. It was obvious to anybody who saw them. Why? Can we figure out why? Why would an owl represent Jews? Okay, so the horns, right? They've got, definitely,
nose.
Got that big Jewish nose, right? An owl has a beak, just like Jews stereotypically were imagined to.
Smart.
They're smart? Okay, maybe. That might be a little bit of a...
In the dark.
Okay, what can we do with that?
So they're good.
Okay, so they sneak around, they can see in the dark, they're cunning, and they're predators, right? Owls are predators. And the fact that they can only see in the dark, again, shows that the Jews are blind to the truth. Jews come out only at night in the darkness of their religion as opposed to the light of the true religion, right? Owls only come out because they're nocturnal, and they only see in the dark. On the right side, right next to that, another very common and unfortunate anti-Jewish icon, the Judensau, the Jewish pig. This was an image that was very, very widespread, especially in Germany, and again, from the 13th century onward, which is when this all begins to pick up. If you went into the town of Frankfurt in the medieval or early modern period, this would be the billboard, the Welcome to Frankfurt sign that you would see. The bridge, we know this from many documents, that led over the Main River into the town of Frankfurt in Germany had a giant tower standing at the foot of the bridge, and emblazoned in gigantic images on that tower was this image of the Judensau, Jews doing horrible things with pigs, which is ironic, of course, because Jews don't eat pigs, and so they were imagined to do all kinds of other disgusting things with pigs. And last but not least, to conclude our little depressing introduction. So within anti-Jewish polemical texts, the idea that Jews are so dumb and so unable to grasp the truth of the competing religions that they're encountering could only be made sense of in light of the fact that they're just not people like the rest of us, right? They're animals. They're not humans. So this is a text, well-known text by Peter the Venerable, very abbot of Cluny in France, a very high-ranking and important church figure, who says, "It seems to me, O Jew, that with so many proof texts and with rational argumentation so extensive, I've satisfied any human being concerning those matters which have been called into question." In other words, we've been debating religion. You think that Judaism is right. I think Christianity is right. I've given you all the proofs I can possibly give you. Any human being would be convinced by now. And if any human being, then you too, if you're in fact human. Because lest I lie, I dare not profess that you are. The irrational faculty which distinguishes human beings from animals and beasts and renders them superior has been obliterated or suppressed in you. Why are you not called a brute animal? Why not a beast or a beast of burden? Consider the cow, or if you prefer the ass, no beast is more stupid, and together with it listen to whatever things those beasts can hear. What will the ass reply? What will distinguish between its hearing and yours? The ass hears but does not understand, and the Jew hears but does not understand. So Jews and dogs, Jews and animals, this is literally dehumanizing Jews, right? Conceptually distinguishing between human beings and members of the Jewish religion. The two are not the same. Now, if you're a Jewish figure in the Middle Ages or later, how are you going to respond to this? What kinds of views of animals will you find or generate within your own tradition that allows you to make sense of this conceptual divide between humanity and animality? How is somebody who's being rendered an animal by the outside world going to understand the role of animals within their own tradition? Now, the answer for the most part seems to have been that Jews embrace this divide between humans and animals. In other words, yes, beasts are lowly, beasts are subordinate, beasts are much, much worse than us, but to reverse it, right? And to say, we're the human beings, and it's actually others who, you know, especially those who are persecuting us, are demonstrating beastly or animal traits or tendencies. So I gave you just a couple of examples of ways in which animals from Tanakh and onward are figured in extremely negative ways. So if we think about the role of dogs in the Torah, what kinds of texts are going to jump to mind right away? So Dvarim Chav Gimel, Lo Tavi Etnan Zonah Umechir Kelev, Beit Hashem Elokecha L'chol Neder, Ki Tu'avat Hashem Elokecha Gam Shnehem. When you are going to the Beit HaMikdash and you want to buy animals to sacrifice, when you want to go right and use your funds, what kinds of money is off limits to use in the Beit HaMikdash? So any money that you've earned through prostitution, okay, that's a to'eva to Hashem for understandable reasons, or any money you've earned by selling a dog. Okay, the money that you've earned from selling dogs is off limits to avat Hashem Elokecha gam shnehem. Okay, it's disgusting. It's disgraceful. Shmuel Bet, this is just, again, one of many, many examples we could bring.
Are we allowed to ask questions, by the way?
You can, sure.
What's wrong with selling a dog?
Well, that's a great question. The Mefarshim spent a lot of time trying to figure out, but what I'd suggest is the underlying implication is that dogs are gross. Dogs are beastly and disgusting.
Dogs are man's best friend.
So let's get to there. Ben.
They weren't pets then. They were scavengers. They went around. They ate garbage.
Exactly. Terrific. So you're all wonderful. So I could have skipped this whole section, right? Because we all know, I think, or it's clear, that when you come across dogs in the Torah, they are not positively figured, almost without exception. And again, I just gave a few of the many examples we could bring here. Shmuel Bet, when Mephibosheth and David, for those who know the story, right, and there's tension over who's going to be the king, the descendants of Shaul or David HaMelech. So they have an encounter in Shmuel Bet Perek Tet where he says to David, Vayishachavu, he bows to him and he says, Vayomer mavdecha ki panita el hakelev hamet asher kamoni. Why have you, somebody who's so glorious, turned to a dead dog like me? Now the implication, of course, is that the glory of the king stands in stark distinction, not just to dogs, but to a dead dog is the most disgusting thing you can possibly imagine, right? Worse than any other kind of animal. The top of page 4 on the source sheet from Yeshayahu. This is how Yeshayahu castigates the people of his day who are not listening to his prophetic messages. Ivrim kulam, right? The people are wholly dumb. Lo yadu kulam klavim ilmim lo yuchlu linboach, right? Mute dogs who are unable to bark. And he goes on to describe other characteristics of dogs. They're selfish, they're greedy, they're grasping, right? They only have negative characteristics. In the interest of time, we're going to run through a few more of these sources quickly to get to our main point, which is going to be the way that all this tradition is received in the Middle Ages. But
what are we going these quotes for? What's the point?
So, as I said, we're trying to lay out a Jewish view of animals, a typical Jewish view of animals that emerges from Tanakh and from Chazal, and we're going to see, we'll get there, how other sources that we're going to be laying out stand in distinction to that. Okay, so hold, buckle your seatbelts, we're heading for interesting and I hope provocative material. But again, just to finish laying out some of this this worldview, source 2 Gimel, this is from Bavli Baba Kama, okay, Masechet Baba Kama, Daf Pei Gimel, which discusses what kinds of animals you are and are not allowed to raise in the land of Israel. Okay, what kinds of animals are off limits? So the Gemara tells a story that we don't have time to get into now, a story that has to do with the time of the Chashmonaim, in which a pig was used in kind of a disgraceful way in Yerushalayim. Read the story if you're interested. The upshot of that story is, Beotasha Amru, Arur Ha'ish Shigadel Chazirim. Okay, and this is still an issue in Israel. Okay, you're cursed if you raise pigs in the land of Israel. A, because they're treif, right? And B, because pigs are the most, in Jewish texts, right, the most characteristic treif animal. When you talk about things that are treif, what do you say? You say they're chazer treif, right? Because pig is the most treif thing for all kinds of reasons, symbolic reasons that we can imagine. And then the Gemara continues, Tanu Rabbanan, Lo yigdal adam et hakelev. You also can't raise dogs. Ela im kein kashur b'shal shelet, unless they're chained up really, really well, okay? Because the assumption is, again, dogs are ferocious, dogs are harmful, dogs are going to come after you if they have the chance. You can, on the borders, right, on the frontier, you can sort of raise dogs and at least let them run free at night. That's okay. You're not in an area of human habitation, so there's no threat. And then the Gemara goes on to say, Tanya Rabbi Eliezer, Agadol Omer, Hamigadel Klavim, Ki Migadel Chazirim. Raising dogs is just as bad as raising pigs. And the Gemara then says, Lainaf Gemina, what? Okay, so what's this equation coming to teach us? Why point out the fact that the two have something in common? And the Gemara says, "Lemeikam alei be'arur," to tell you that when they ruled in the times of the second Beit Hamikdash, arur ish amegadel chazirim, they also meant dogs. Okay, not only is it prohibited, not only are dogs dangerous, but you're cursed if you raise them. You're cursed if you have them in your house. Now, these examples could be multiplied ad infinitum, almost. But I hope the point that comes across is that Jews are being figured as beastly, and the typical response is, yes, animals and especially dogs are awful, but we have nothing to do with them. The last example that I'll give, source number 3. This is a piyut from Shlomo HaBavli. Shlomo HaBavli is a paitan from the 10th century in Italy. Despite his name, he writes in Italy, is a very, very influential figure. Ashkenazic Jewry, some of you may know, the roots of Ashkenazic Jewry are in Italy. The early families of Ashkenaz migrated north in the 10th century from Italy. So this is somebody who's very connected to this Ashkenazic culture. And he says, Yavozu, yavozu yedidecha yichanum klavim. They, the Gentiles, they disgrace us by calling us dogs. Okay, he knows this. He's aware that this is a specific accusation. And then he goes on to say, but it's not us who's doing foolish, silly things. Tipesh komer v'naval ta'ar ha-galavim, which is a way of saying galchim. In other words, the priests, the Christian priests, who are laying these accusations on us, they're foolish. And the ta'ar ha-galchim refers to tonsure, right? Monks and priests in the Middle Ages and earlier would cut a patch in the middle of their head, right? They would tonsure their heads, and that's what is being referred to here. So it's naval, it's disgusting. Zar lo nishlavim v'alecha nitzlavim. Slav means crucifixion, okay? So they are the ones who are bowing and praying to, forgive me, this is what our author means, to disgusting corpses, to crucified, in other words, who's gross? It's not us, okay? It's them. They call us dogs, but we know who's really the one who is embracing these animal beastly things. Now, with all that in mind, let's take a look at source number 4. I've given you the very quick and dirty, rushed tour of animals in pre-medieval Jewish thought. Let's take a look at source number 4. This comes from a text called Sefer Kushiyot, or in some manuscripts it's called Kushiyot Mile Da'alma. It was only recently published within the last 2 years. It survives in 3 different manuscripts, and it basically consists of a list of hundreds of questions and answers in very short, pithy sort of back and forth. Tikshilach X, Teretz Y. It's from the early 14th century. The way that scholars figured this out is because if you want to know what date a text comes from, so how are you going to do it? You look for which authorities are cited in the text, and wherever those citations end, so you have a pretty good guess that it was sometime soon after that that the text comes from. So the last scholars who are cited in this text are the students of the Maharami Ruttenberg, or the mayor of Rothenburg, who lives in the late 13th century. And so it's around the late 13th or early 14th century that we have this text. And it's a fascinating text for a number of reasons, because the questions have no relationship to one another. It's a really random list of what the burning questions that were on the minds of people in the 14th century. If you want a kind of a psychological profile of Ashkenazic Jews in the 14th century, these are the 300 top burning questions that they needed to pose to their rabbis and to get answers to. And one of the questions is, Tikshilach, we're in source number 4, Mipnei ma korim umot ha'olam lihudim klavim. Why is it that the Gentiles, the goyim, forgive me, right? That's how they would have used the term. Why do they call us dogs? Now, what kind of answer would we expect? Shlomo HaBavli asked the same question. And he said, because they're wrong, because they're gross. What's the answer that Sefer HaKushiyot gives us? Teretz lefi shenemar banim atem laHashem Elokeichem banim b'gematria klavim. Because the pasuk says you are the sons of God, you are the sons of Hashem your God, and the gematria of banim, it's true, it works out, is klavim. You are God's dogs. Now what does that mean? There's a second answer. V'gam katuv, ki li b'nei Yisrael, right? We all know this pasuk, I assume, ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim, roshei tevot, klavai, ki li b'nei Yisrael, you are my dogs. Now obviously we have a very, very different image of dogs that's emerging here, and of animals in general, right? I mean, what's the sort of presumption underlying a text like this one? So this is the issue that was raised before. What about man's best friend? This is the idea that dogs are loyal, that dogs are loving, that dogs are a member of the household, right? That if the Jewish people are dogs, that's a compliment, okay? Because it's a very positive thing to be a member, a loyal member of the household who serves the master, i.e. Hashem. Now, where does this come from? This, I hope I've shown you, just based on these samplings, this is a very dramatic turnaround, okay? This is not something we find in earlier sources. But what I'd like to argue in the time that we have left is that it's actually very characteristic of a move in medieval Ashkenaz in the 13th century and onward to equate Jews with animals in a positive way. Now, this is not something that we see in a widespread way in earlier sources, I would suggest. We don't have time to go through all of the early texts. But in Ashkenaz in the 12th and 13th century, at precisely the moment that Jews are being called senseless beasts, Jews are seizing on the symbol of animals and putting this very positive spin on it, almost breaking down ke'ilu, the boundaries between these two categories of human and animal. This has all kinds of interesting implications. We're only going to have time to talk about a very few of them here, but we're going to look at a couple of texts that I hope will give you a sense that this polarization between animals and humans that seems to have been taken for granted by Christians and was taken for granted by earlier Jewish sources begins to be mitigated. And we'll have to talk about all the different implications that has. Please, Dr. Blyvis.
Is there a correlation with starting to use animal names?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. That's a great question, right? Names like Zev or... Yeah, it's a really good question that I honestly have not looked into. I will look into it now because I think it's a really... If we could find a shift in naming patterns, I think that would be a very significant thing. And I don't know what the answer to that is. Thank you for raising that. Please.
Why are the Jews... You know, you asked the question, initially the Goyim called us dogs. Then you asked, what's the Jewish response? And then it sounds like the Jews kind of turned it around for good, right? Why did they do that? What was their goal?
Great question. Let's try to figure it out. I think this is exactly where we need to be heading, right? I'd like to give a couple of examples here of ways in which this animal-human divide begins to be blurred, both with regards to dogs, but also to some extent with regard to animals in general. Let's take a look at source number 5. Again, Ashkenaz, late 12th or early 13th century. There's a text called Sefer Chassidim. If you hang out with me long enough, you eventually hear me talk about this text. Written by Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid and his students. Okay, very important halachic and exegetical, right, a parshan and a mystic, somebody who writes lots of Torah Hasod. Very, very fascinating character. Sefer Chassidim is a collection of his teachings in which he says, Lama tziva lechasot, why is it that we were commanded to cover? To cover what? So he's referring to kisui hadam. Okay, the Torah in Vayikra tells us when you slaughter an animal, certain kinds of animals, there's all kinds of regulations, so we have to cover up the blood of the slaughtered animal with dirt. Why? So the Torah doesn't say, well, the Torah does say why. It says, ki adam hu hanefesh. But what that means is not entirely clear. Poskim and Parshanim through the ages give lots of different explanations for why we do kisui hadam. There's halachic explanations that have been offered, right? Ki adam hu hanefesh. When you have blood, you're not allowed to eat it, right? It's prohibited. What's the surest way to make sure we're not going to eat the forbidden blood from the animal? Toss dirt all over it, okay? In other words, now we know you're not going to eat it because it's been covered in dirt. Sefer HaChinuch explains, based on the Rambam's approach to these kinds of issues, that the reason we do kisui hadam is because it would be a little bit sort of not menschlich to eat meat with the animal's blood lying out in front of us, right? He says, yesh ktsat achzariyut. Not because it's cruel to animals to slaughter them. Of course you're supposed to slaughter animals. But he says specifically because when you are around blood that much, you may come to act cruelly to people. right? People are worthy of protection. Animals are not worthy of protection, but we cover up the animal's blood so it won't inculcate any kind of cruelty, right, or coarseness within human beings. What's the explanation that Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid gives? So it couldn't be more different. Ki briot bereshit yesh mimuna alehem. All creatures have somebody appointed over them. And what he means is an angel. Ve'omer ribono shel olam. The angel is going to come to God and say, Master of the universe, ze chotev ze eno chotev, eich yuchal hachayav et she'eno chotev. This is an innocent creature, the animal. This is a horrible sinner. We're all sinners, right? Human beings. How are you allowing a sinner to slaughter and kill an innocent creature? Lekach tziva lechasot dam. That's why we have to cover up the blood. Pein yomar hamimuna nishchat zakai v'ashochet chayav. Shekol zman shehu bigalui hamimuna yomar v'hadam tzoik. Because as long as the blood is exposed, the angel who is appointed over the animal is going to see it and will bring the rightful claim before Hashem that we have sinned by killing and consuming animals. Okay? It's a sinful thing to do. And so we hide it. Kisui Adam is about hiding from the angels. Umashe Tziva L'chasot Et Adam, the text continues, Kedei Shelo Yehem Munah Kategor, She'Chayav Zoche Shochet Et HaChayav. Okay? We don't want the... Et HaZakai, rather. We don't want the Chayav, right? The person who's a sinner, to sin against the innocent. Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid goes further, explains in Source 5a, Kishe Shochet Adam Chayav O'of Yachshov Bilibo. He should think as he's slaughtering, Zeh Shelo Chatan Yishchat, Vitzolin oto. We slaughter and cook animals. Adam shehu malei avonot, eichinatzel mishvuchot damim migehenim. So we too, how can we escape death and fiery punishment? This is a very sort of depressing thought, right? But cooking animals is supposed to remind us of our own mortality. And the unjust things that we're inflicting on this animal should remind us that we too are heading in that direction if we don't change. And it goes on to say, "V'tziva Kadosh Baruch Hu lechasot dam chayav ha'ov." We have to cover up their blood. Pain yomar malach amuna alehem eich dam zeh shelo chatan yishbach al yedei chote asher chataim keshanim v'chatola v'chot min medam et hanigzar lamavet, etc., etc. L'fichat tziva lechasot hadam. We have to cover up the blood to hide it. Okay, because slaughtering animals is essentially a sinful thing to do. Now, I'm not personally a vegetarian, and I'm not going to tell anybody they have to be, right? But what we're finding here is a rare, what would seem initially like a rare text, that's collapsing this distinction between humans who are superior over animals and animals who deserve whatever it is that humans do to them. Slaughtering animals is not, it's not pashut. The idea that we have a right to kill innocent creatures is so troubling and so problematic that God commanded us to cover up the blood precisely as a way to avoid divine retribution. Now, where does this idea come from? So, another text in Sefer Chassidim gives us a clue. And it's on Source 5b, on top of page 5. Tell me if this sounds familiar. Bayit shenehergu bo al kiddush Hashem. If you have a house where people were killed as martyrs, where Jews were slaughtered, who was slaughtering Jews in the 12th and 13th century in Germany? So, we know this is Christian attackers. Ve'adam nitaz al achoma. And blood, Rahman al Tzlan, is everywhere. It's on the walls, it's on the stones of the house. Okay, there are physical signs that there was a crime against Jews committed here. Ubala bayit balituach besid, kirot habayit, et adam lo ya'avir, v'lo yiyatachalav. If you want to come and renovate the house, fix things up, make it habitable again, you are forbidden from covering up the blood. You may not paint or plaster over, right? Cover up the blood of these martyrs. Shnemar eretz al tachasidami. Lekach ein lechasot. In this instance, you are not allowed to cover the blood. Why? Harei kol zman she'ein hadam mechuseh, HaKadosh Baruch Hu nokem. Ukshu mechuseh eino memaher linkom. Because exposed blood brings about divine retribution. And in this case, we want it. Right? In this case, we are eager to display this blood because it will arouse God to come to our defense and to avenge us against from our enemies. Now, this is the exact flip side of what we saw a moment ago, right? Who are the animals here? The Jews. The Jews who go like lambs to the slaughter, right? And we need to keep their blood exposed for the same reason that for animals, we need to cover it up. Because in both instances, an innocent creature has been targeted, and we either want to hide or to expose and highlight the fact that this is going to lead to some kind of divine judgment. Okay, that Hashem can't help but respond, or his angels can't help but respond to the sight of exposed innocent blood. So again, we're seeing that within this context of Jews being attacked, within the context of Jews being treated in an inhuman way, the linkage between Jews and animals, and specifically their blood, is being highlighted here, I think, in a very direct kind of way.
It's contradictory.
How so?
Well, you see that by the first case, by the dumb of the bird, that the Metatron, or this angel, is going to the Ketager. He's going to become a Ketager.
Mm-hmm.
So similarly, with the next case, you shouldn't cover over the blood, and then we Jews have lots of malachim out. And by covering the blood, we would have got them angry and said, do something.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I'm not sure that's a contradiction at all, though. I think that
why should you cover the blood here and not cover the blood there?
Because in one instance, we want God to avenge the innocent creature, and in one instance, we don't. If God avenges the innocent Jews, he will kill their Christian attackers. If God avenges the innocent ox, then that's us, right? We're the ones who killed it.
No.
So, right?
But the concept is that by covering...
By covering, the blood doesn't call out to God anymore. Angels are attracted to this. And again, this link between Jews and animals, I hope, is relatively clear in this context. Let's take a look at one or two more examples in the time that we have remaining. How much time do we have remaining? Is he here? 15 minutes? Okay, perfect. Tana Rabbanan. So the Gemara says in Masechta Bava Kamma, again, we're back in Masechta Bava Kamma, a very interesting and strange passage. Klavim bochim... Malach HaMavet Bala'ir. Klavim Misachakim, Eliyahu HaNavi Bala'ir. If you hear dogs howling and crying, you can be certain that the Malach HaMavet is coming. Okay? Death will be visiting your city. Whereas, if you see dogs laughing, now I don't have a dog, I've never seen a dog laugh, but I can only assume it's referring to some kind of tail wagging, joyous behavior. What does that mean? Redemption is imminent. Eliyahu HaNavi is on his way. Now, what in the world this pairing means has been an issue that many Mefarshim have tried to understand. And I want to take a look at, again, within our context that we're highlighting, late medieval Ashkenaz, a particularly unique and I think very interesting approach. This comes from a text called Sefer Malkiel. Sefer Malkiel was written by a certain Malkiel Chizkiah ben Avraham. It's not 100% clear who this guy is. Hopefully it'll be clearer soon. But he writes probably in the early 14th century in Ashkenaz. His text has a lot of German loazim in it, right? German transcribed words. And he's clearly operating within this same kind of Ashkenazi setting. Sefer Malkiel was published actually many, many times from a very early date. So this text was well known at a certain point. Today it's very hard to find except for PDFs online. So it's not a text that has aged well. People, for whatever reason, have not continued to read it. But it was printed and reprinted over and over again in Europe, and so at a certain point it exercised a lot of influence. Now, Sefer Malkiel consists of explanations of puzzling and troubling Talmudic Agadot. Okay? Agadot like this one. Why are dogs excited about Eliyahu and sad about the Malach HaMavet? And says Malkiel, Chizkiah ben Avraham, Kama elu advarim ma'avirim enei haksilim. Texts like this one, so they blind fools, right? It doesn't make any sense, seemingly. But if you understand them, so then how enlightening must they become? Etc. When you really understand these agadot, so then you see the genius and the brilliance of Chazal. So what genius and brilliance can we take away here? We're going to skip around a little bit. The second paragraph, where the middle of the line says, Kach inyan be'atzmo, min hasarim asher mashbi'im kocham al minei ba'alei chayim. So Rav Malkiel started with a text from the Gemara that talks about how every creature in the world has an angel appointed over it. And we know this, right? No blade of grass, the Gemara says, grows unless an angel basically smacks it and says, like, get to it. Okay? Angels are directly controlling all created beings in the world, including all kinds of animals. And he goes on to say, Heim hamishtal shalim ma'ala ma'ala. Now, there's an angelic hierarchy, because not all angels are the same. We know that there are groups of angels, and some angels are superior to others. And that corresponds, he says, to the different kinds of animals, some of which are superior to others. So superior animals are going to have superior angels. Inferior animals have inferior angels. Omnam hasar o hamalach mashpia kochol ahari Einu mishtalshel me'oto ha'makor shemishtalshel mimenu hasar mashpia kocho al ha'shor. Okay, so for example, lions have better angels than oxen, because lions, we all know, are the kings of the jungle. Oxen, right, not so much. Domesticated animals. So we have an angelic and an animal hierarchy. Now let's go on to the second paragraph, the third paragraph at the bottom. Ubiorze, so what can we take away from this? Ki hakelev yeshlo emuna v'hu even ne'eman la'aduno. In other words, dogs are loyal, dogs are loving, dogs serve their masters. Their angels, therefore, must come from a root of emunah, okay? Of ne'emanut, of trustworthiness, of loyalty. Omnam, any cat people here? Sorry, Rabelinsky. Hachatul oshar biyot she'ein lahem ne'emanut, ki ima sheker, Heim nishpim gam kein mimakur shekarut kumo samael v'nishpim mimenu. In other words, bad, deceitful, unloyal animals like cats, so they come from a demonic source. Samael is the medieval Hebrew term for Satan, okay, for the devil. So their angels are also operating within this cosmic hierarchy, but on the wrong side. In Kabbalah, we say this is the Sitra Achra, right? The demonic side. So if you're a dog person or a cat person, sorry, but there's a theological value judgment there. He goes on to say, Kibiderech zenida, ki hashedim u'malachei Kabbalah, heim nishba'im yisod. So demons, right, and destructive angels, that's all cats, okay? Whereas dogs, so that's loyalty and faith and trust in God. Let's turn the page. Therefore, at the very top of the page, Bevo Eliyahu Zala'ir, Achat B'shlichut Adono, when Eliyahu comes to town, Barur, Hu Asher Yishalchenu Elav, Yilavei Lav HaMalach Asher Hu, Mufkad Alav, Ein Zerachot Ki Yaakov Avinu, etc., etc. Okay, he goes on to talk about some specific examples. In other words, when Eliyahu comes to town, who are the angels that come with him? He obviously represents the good side, Emunah, Ne'emanut, being a loyal servant, right? Eliyahu is a servant of God. And therefore, so we're going to skip here in the interest of time, when he comes to town, so the dogs are happy, okay? Because dogs are good, dogs are symbolizing all kinds of wonderful traits, and their angels, when they come, cause dogs to be joyous. You can sort of tell by animal behavior what kinds of theological messengers, what kinds of spiritual messengers have come. By implication, and he draws this out later on, when Eliyahu comes to town, cats get angry, okay? And when the Malach HaMavet comes to town, cats get happy, but dogs are crying. Okay, now what can we make of this? It's in a certain sense, the explanation here is as troubling as the Agadah that he's trying to explain. But for our purposes, what I think we can see is, again, there's been this dramatic shift from etnan zonah u'mechir kelev to klavim as symbolizing emunah and ne'emanut. And that's how we can make sense of this Agadah. Animals have been refigured in a very positive kind of way. In the time we have remaining, I'm going to jump through two more examples very, very quickly. Sources 7 and 7a cite a famous and, again, very troubling rabbinic Agadah that has to do with the life of Adam in Gan Eden prior to the creation of Chava. And if you do Shnayim Mikra, right, if you read Rashi, so this is not an Agadah that is new to you. What is Rashi quoting the Midrash say? He says that when the Pasuk says, Vayomer Adam zot ha'pa'am etzem me'atzamai u'basar mi'bsari, that now finally Chava has been created, and I found a wonderful partner. Zot hapam implies that he had other partners that he tried to conjoin with prior to the creation of Chava. So Rashi says, "Milamit sheba Adam al kol behemah v'chayot, v'lo nikara daito ad sheba al Chava." In other words, Adam had a Chava Amina that maybe animals are going to be his partner in the world, right? And he sort of worked his way sequentially, trying to identify a fitting partner within each animal, until finally Chava was created and he realized that the link is going to be to another human being and not to an animal. Now, what do you do with a text like this in a context in which Jews are being equated with animals? Christians knew this text from a relatively early period. I gave you one example here from a German anti-Jewish text called the Alt und die Neue I, which means the Old and New Law. It's a comparison of the Old and New Testaments, the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, in which it says, if Adam coupled with the animals, what else can I learn from that than that apes, asses, and swine are the stepmothers of you Jews? Now, obviously he's not reading this midrash in an attempt to really understand it, right? But it's great polemical ammunition. Jews are beasts. Jews are are animals. Just 1 second, if you don't mind. In 1240, when Rabbi Yechiel Mipari debates a Christian priest who was a former Jew called Nicholas Donin. Anybody heard of the Trial of the Talmud? So this is a disputation that takes place in Paris in the 1240s and eventually leads to 24 cartloads, according to tradition, of Talmudic manuscripts being burned because they found passages like this within it. So Nicholas Donin singles out this passage as the classic example of the fact that Jews are irrational and beastly and animalistic. How do Jews respond? So we know, take questions just 1 second. We know that in these kinds of contexts, in disputations, Jews were often willing to say, all right, it's a medrash, you know? What can I tell you? The Ramban, when he confronts Pablo Christiani in 1263, another famous disputation where Jews and Christians debate over the Talmud, is presented with all kinds of agadot, and the Ramban says, you know what, there's a lot of agadot that say a lot of things. There's a word for it in Spanish. We call them sermones. Okay? And when you go to synagogue and the rabbi gives a sermon, so maybe you like it, maybe you don't, right? I mean, I'm in a shul, so the Ramban said it, not me. In other words, let's not go crazy over all of these agadot. We don't need to accept all of them. That's a very classic response that Yechiel Mipari does not take advantage of. What he says in Source 7 Gimel is V'al shamru avotenu sheba adam al kol behemav chaya v'lo nitkara daito ad she nizda v'glechava din hu lo markach. It's absolutely right, because that's what the pasuk says. It says Zot Hapam, and he recites the whole midrash. Ubezel lo chata shadayin lo husar b'kach. And anyway, we're in a pre-Ma'amad Har Sinai period. Bestiality has not been prohibited, so why would we assume that there's anything wrong with it unless HaKadosh Baruch Hu prohibits it? Again, what's the underlying rationale here? The linkage between Jews and animals, especially when Jews are being called beastly. Okay, the linkage is not so problematic. Yeah, okay, we're animals. We think animals within the Jewish tradition have a very elevated status. And so, fine, eventually, things like bestiality are ruled out. But until they are, why should we assume that the divide between humans and beasts, and again, this is not meant to denigrate humans, but to elevate animals. Okay, there are a bunch of questions. Maybe we'll take a... We don't have time. Okay, so maybe I'll make one more quick point, and then I'm happy to talk to people as much as we have time for. We're going to skip a little bit around. Take a look at page 7. 13th century Germany is the same time that we begin to see pictorial depictions of Jews as animals in very, very famous cases. People recognize the bird's head Haggadah. This is sort of a classic of medieval Jewish artwork. There's been a lot of explanations given as to why Jews are depicted in the bird's head Haggadah as animals, as literally beasts. Some of the explanations... Well, let's think like historians. Why might Jews be depicted with birds' heads in texts like these ones?
Big noses,
yeah. So one of the great examples, right? I tell my students at Northwestern, when they're looking at texts like these, think like an anti-Semite, okay? And sometimes I have an easy time, too easy a time thinking that way. If you're looking at a bird's head, so think about that owl that we saw before, right? The crooked-nosed, beaked owl that symbolizes all kinds of anti-Semitic visual cues. So many scholars have argued that the bird's head Haggadah was illuminated not by Jews, but by Christians. Christian artists are the ones who drew this, and that's why they snuck in this message of anti-Jewish facial characteristics. Now, that's not convincing for all kinds of reasons. There's other explanations that have been given, too. The most famous one, probably, that we know is that you're not allowed to draw human beings, right? We don't draw people. That's being over on the Second Commandment. So, as a result, we need to draw them as animals. The problem with that is that if you take a look at almost all medieval Jewish art, there's human faces everywhere. Nobody took this seriously. Almost nobody took this seriously, as far as we know. I gave you just one example on the next page, Source 9a, which is a great text that we don't have time to get into, it looks like. But here we have Bnei Yisrael and Hashem. This is an illumination of Shir HaShirim, okay, where we have the Dodi and Ra'ayati, and they represent, in rabbinic tradition, Bnei Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and they're being depicted as humans, unselfconsciously, unproblematically. Okay, human faces, not just human faces, but human faces representing God. Now, why then do we have this bird's head imagery? So here's my suggestion. It's because being depicted as an animal was not seen as a bad thing. If anything, it could be seen as a glorious thing. And if you take a look at the very last page of the sheet and the bottom, you'll see that according to one recent, and I think very convincing, historical account, the bird's head Haggadah is not a picture of birds. It's actually a picture of a medieval animal called a griffin. And if you take a look at the griffin, which is in the bottom of the page here, it's a combination of an eagle and a lion. This was the most glorious kind of animal that you could possibly figure yourself as. The eagle is the most prominent bird. The lion is the king of the jungle. Medieval people believed that there were lion eagles, right, that fused these two together. And this was an image of royalty, of power, of chosenness. And so the birds had Haggadah for all kinds of artistic reasons. There's a very convincing claim to be made that it's actually the griffin's head Haggadah. And so this isn't a picture being snuck in by Gentiles to make Jews look like anti-Semitic icons. It's a picture of Jews embracing animal symbolism and animal imagery as a way of making themselves look chosen. Now, what we can take away from all of this in brief, because we've only gone through a very selective number of sources, is that when Jews are confronted in the Middle Ages with a kind of an anti-Jewish bestial trope, the automatic response is not only to say, you got it wrong, or to turn it around and say, no, you're the animals. In a certain instance, there's almost an elevation of certain texts and traditions within Judaism that say, you know what, you're right. We are animal in a certain way. We're loyal like dogs. We're royal like lions. Okay, we take this newfound anti-Jewish ammunition and turn it around, invert it into a source of pride. And that can explain these and several others interesting and surprising developments from the Middle Ages that we don't have time to talk about now, but we'll have to wait for a future talk. Thank you all very much for your attention, and have a great day. Do we have time for questions? Okay. So we have time for maybe a couple of quick questions. Please.
First of all, when this German writer says that
Mm-hmm.
Descendants of animals?
Yeah.
100%. I don't think we should look for consistency or, you know, good parshanut in these kind of, the accusation is meant to dehumanize, and I don't think he sort of sat there thinking like, well, you know.
The second thing is, you don't mention Eric Shira, where at the end of mm-hmm. Eric Shira, it clearly describes dogs as being a benefit to Judaism.
Yeah. Perek Shira is a great text, a really fascinating text, whose history is also very unclear. What we can say is that Perek Shira was, I don't want to say it was written, but was privileged specifically in 12th and 13th century Ashkenaz. So many of the manuscripts that survive of Perek Shira are written by the Hasidei Ashkenazi students of Yehuda Hasid. They cite from it. It made its way into a lot of artwork from the time. So I think actually your point is really great. Perek Shira is something that in this context they're seizing upon, because it has traditions of wonderful, God-fearing animals that they can use in exactly this kind of context.
I think we're out of time.
Thank you, everybody. I'm happy to talk to people afterwards. I will